This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.EDU. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. The run-up to the confirmation of Supreme Court Justice Samuel Alito was a contentious one. Several Democratic senators tried unsuccessfully to launch a filibuster to block the confirmation vote. One of the issues that made the Alito debate heated one was abortion, and now less than a month after being sworn in as the 110th justice, the court this week said it would hear arguments in the Justice Department's appeal to reinstate a ban on what some call partial birth abortions. In an editorial this week on February 21, 2006, the New York Times said if the court reverses quickly the partial abortion rulings of lower courts, it would, quote, undermine not just abortion rights, but the court's own authority. Abortion is not the only hot-button issue the Roberts Court faces. There is a pair of cases before the court that involve the Clean Water Act. The Times editorial on these cases this week concluded that the court could use the cases to scale back Congress's powers. Well, this afternoon, what we're going to do in this portion of the program is to take a look at the role of partisanship and ideology in the nomination and confirmation process for federal judges and justices. Our guest is political scientist Jeffrey Siegel. He is the author, the co-author with Lee Epstein of Advice and Consent, The Politics of Judicial Appointments. The book is a guide for general readers. Listeners, I invite you to join our discussion with your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, use the toll-free number 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest. Jeffrey Siegel is a distinguished professor and department chair of political science at Stony Brook University. His areas of teaching interest include constitutional law, civil liberties, judicial behavior, and judicial process. Advice and Consent is published by Oxford University Press. And again, the phone numbers 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. Professor Siegel, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Well, thank you for having me on. It's a pleasure.
Is the intense fighting over party and ideology for candidates for the federal judiciary a new phenomenon?
No, this has gone back to the beginning of the court. Even George Washington had one of his candidates turned down because of the nominee's politics. On the other hand, it has gotten worse in recent years. So we do see many more, you know, much more vitriol in these things than we have in some of the past years.
Yeah. Why has it gotten worse?
Well, because the court has taking an, you know, keeps getting involved in political issues that bring up people's, get people worried, like abortion and civil rights. You know, it started with civil rights and then abortion and reapportionment and these things. So to the extent that the Supreme Court is deciding issues on abortion rights, then the public is going to be very concerned as to which side of that issue the justices are on.
Yeah. What's been the most intense, most contentious fight over a Supreme Court nominee in our history?
Well, Robert Bork was pretty close to the most contentious. Clarence Thomas as well, because you had not just the politics of Thomas's ideology, but the whole question over the Anita Hill scandal. But if you go back to Louis Brandeis, back in during the Wilson administration, there was just terrible fights over his nomination. So we've had these bitter fights many, many times in the past. But with the media being as it is, and with the internet and bloggers and all these things, it's probably getting worse.
Hmm. Why was the Brandeis nomination contentious?
Because Brandeis was seen as an economic radical, and all of the vested interests in the country banded together to fight him. He was sort of the leader of the progressive cause for trying to get social justice. And so you had the Wall Street Journal and the American Bar Association and the president of Harvard University and a former president of the United States and all these people ganging up and attacking him. you know, his progressive causes were seen as socialism.
Hmm. You mentioned interest groups, media, bloggers, as players in the process. Are we seeing greater attention from these players, and how big a role do they play in the process?
Well, they're playing an increasing role. We see during the Harriet Myers nomination, for instance, there was, you know, this huge outcry over her lack of credentials, and surprisingly, it came from many of the people who should have been on the president's side, and that's something that's almost never been seen before. The media pays much, much more attention to these nominations, not just the Supreme Court, but the Court of Appeals as well. When John Roberts was nominated for the Court of Appeals originally, actually he didn't get confirmed originally, but there wasn't much attention to it. These days when there are battles over the Court of Appeals, it ends up being filibustered, and this is stuff that we've never seen before.
Yeah, and what about at the trial court level?
There hasn't been that level of fighting there. The Court of Appeals have much more influence, so we haven't yet seen these sorts of fights over district court judges.
I wonder if it could be coming.
It's possible. It's possible, but there, you know, the district courts are deciding cases one issue at a time. And the impact of those decisions is not very great. The Court of Appeals is deciding cases for an entire, so the United States is divided up into 11 circuits. The Court of Appeals is deciding cases, each Court of Appeals for its circuit, you know, for the whole circuit at a time. And then, of course, the Supreme Court for the whole country at a time. So a district court decision doesn't have much of an impact beyond the immediate parties to the suit, only if that gets appealed. And then the Court of Appeals decided, then the ruling is holds for the entire circuit. And if it goes to the Supreme Court, it holds for the entire country.
So more clout, more visibility.
Yes.
Yeah. One of the interesting things to run across in your book was this statement: all but 17 of the 147 candidates for a position on the nation's highest court belong to the same party as the president at the time of nomination. Would we be better served if our judges were less partisan and tended toward being neutral?
No, there's very little democratic control on the Supreme Court, and by that I mean small d democratic. And that once they're on, they're pretty free to do what they want. So the public, either directly or indirectly, you know, since we are a democracy, should have some say in this. And one of the ways that they can have a say is through who they elect as president. I mean, elections really should matter. So if the Warren Court, for instance, happens to go in a very liberal direction, you know, and it's not as they did, then if people aren't happy about that, and, you know, Richard Nixon ran for president saying he wanted Supreme Court justices who are more conservative on criminal matters, and he won, and he got to appoint four justices who were more conservative. Since there's no sort of pure application to the Constitution, it's a political document, and it will inevitably be read politically. I don't know that we can even hope for sort of a neutral reading of it, but this is the one democratic control we have over this is through presidential elections.
Mm-hmm. 1971, Nixon made a cross-party appointment.
Yeah.
What led him to do that, and in the past, what led presidents to make cross-party appointments?
Well, Nixon nominated Lewis Powell as part of his Southern strategy. Nixon was, you know, the South had long been under, Democratic control, but it was also a very conservative area. And because of the Democratic Party, the National Democratic Party support for civil rights, Nixon thought that the Republicans could make great headway in the South. And Nixon was looking to looking forward to the 1972 election and hoping to carry a large number of southern states.
So we have another layer of politics.
Oh, yeah, right. So if you think, well, this was a non-political act by naming a Democrat, no, quite the opposite. It was in order to, you know, to show the Southern Democrats, this policy had a name. It was called the Southern Strategy. Mm-hmm. And he had first nominated Haynesworth and then Carswell, two Southerners, both of whom got rejected. And Nixon at the time said, well, this just shows that, the Senate will not confirm a Southerner. And then he ended up appointing Blackmun to that position. But Nixon proved himself wrong with Powell in that the Senate was more than willing to confirm a highly qualified Southerner. But this fed well with Nixon's plan to gain support in the South. Eisenhower nominated the Democrat William Brennan in 1956, in some sense for the same sorts of reasons. Eisenhower did this. This was October 1956. It was 1 month before the presidential election. And Eisenhower, throughout his administration, had tried to be bipartisan and show himself to be above politics. And what better way to make the point that you are above politics than making a very political decision to nominate someone from the opposite party? And that's why one of the reasons he chose Brennan. He had also promised to appoint a Catholic. So he had lots of political angles going on with the Brennan nomination.
Yeah. In our history, the cross-party nominations, then, have they been largely politically pragmatic?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, every once in a while you get you might get one that's not. But usually there's some political calculus going on with that.
Hmm. Well, partisanship and ideology aside for the moment, how are a jurist's qualifications for the bench judged, sized up?
Well, one of the ways that they're assessed is by experience, having served on state Supreme Courts or courts of appeals and stuff like that. They're assessed by where the candidate went to law school, and they're assessed by levels of public service that the person has been involved with. So, Lewis Powell is considered highly qualified, even though he had never served as a judge, but he'd been president of the American Bar Association and had been active in public affairs throughout his career.
Hmm. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, just recently, though, presidents have, with the exception of Harriet Myers, virtually every nominee since William Rehnquist in 1971 has had prior judicial experience.
Hmm. Any thoughts, any observations, any comments you'd like to make on why President Bush selected Harriet Myers?
We know that he has an affinity for for liking people who are close to him and people that he trusts. And he apparently thought that his word that she was correct on the issues would be good enough for the conservative base, and plus the not too subtle winking that she was a not just a conservative but a religious conservative was supposed to signify that she would support them on issues like Roe v. Wade. He's probably worked with her extensively from her work in the Office of Legal Counsel on questions of detainee rights and stuff like that, and that's something that was very important to him. So this is someone that he had a great deal of personal faith in, and the president, that's an important issue for him, these personal connections. And he thought that she would be, good on the issues that were important to him, which I would put actually these questions on the war on terror far ahead for the president on what he considers most important for the court than what the court might do on abortion.
Yeah.
He hasn't, and I don't believe that this is something that, whatever his personal views might be, that he's placing a great deal of emphasis on in terms of his court nominees, other than placating his base.
Yeah. In the book, you have one of the charts that's in here is a chart of a listing of names mentioned as possible Bush nominees, and hers is not.
Hers is not on,
not
there.
On this. So she was a surprise.
Yes, I think it was George Will, but I'm not 100% certain, who wrote that if you took the 100 top, you know, judicial experts in the country and asked them each to name the 100 top people for the Supreme Court. You'd have 10,000. Well, if, you know, you'd have 10,000 different listings. You wouldn't have 10,000 different people because there would be repeats. But he said that Harriet Meyer's name would not have shown up once. But none of those 100 top experts were elected president of the United States. So this was, you know, to a certain, you know, to a certain subject to Senate confirmation. This was Bush's call.
Yeah. What can you tell us about how a White House compiles its shortlist?
It differs by president. For instance, Lyndon Johnson, you know, knew exactly who he wanted. There's no evidence that he took any recommendations from anyone. He appointed his very good friend Abe Fortas to the Supreme Court. And then he nominated Thurgood Marshall because he wanted to have the first African-American on the Supreme Court. And then in the closing days of his administration, he tried to promote Fortas and then to also get another good friend of his, Congressman Homer Thornberry, on the Supreme Court. Most presidents, though, will set to their attorney general the task of compiling a list of names and vetting candidates and stuff like that. Now, interestingly, the person who was charged with vetting Harriet Myers, so she was the head of the Office of Legal Counsel for the president. The person in charge of vetting her was the was her deputy, who I presumably could have expected that he would have stepped up to her position if she moved on to the Supreme Court. So there was a little bit, he might not have pushed as hard as he might have to find out whether she was acceptable to conservatives.
Well, interesting. How involved in general are presidents in the process of selecting and vetting a candidate for nomination? It seems like this White House leaves it to, at least the vetting part, to someone else, but
yeah. Well, the president won't be directly involved in the vetting per se. What would normally happen is that the attorney general or whoever the president puts in charge will come to the president with a group of names, and then the president might, you know, wish to interview, as President Bush did, several of the candidates, and Bush did you know, meet with many. You know, they don't give the lists out, but it was clear that the president did meet with many of the people under consideration. And as he likes to do, he goes by gut instincts a lot on these things. Other presidents, you know, have met with candidates and done interviews and stuff like that. When Clinton had his first nomination, the one that went to Ruth Bader Ginsburg, he had interviewed Stephen Breyer. Breyer had had a severe bicycle accident like the week before and was in terrible condition and apparently did not interview well, but, you know, Clinton chose Ginsburg, but then with the next nominee, he went back to Breyer.
Yeah. Now, I would imagine Clinton, and we talked about Johnson briefly so far, and Roosevelt being quite involved.
Yeah, absolutely. Roosevelt certainly very concerned about what the Supreme Court did. Clinton was concerned, but he had other issues. I mean, he was, remember, he at one point wanted to nominate Mario Cuomo, and then Cuomo kind of turned it down or whatever, and that's when he went with Ginsburg. Yeah, so Johnson, Roosevelt probably toward the top of the list of presidents who took an active role.
This is the Afternoon Magazine, and our guest this afternoon, political scientist Jeffrey Siegel. He is the co-author with Lee Epstein of Advice and Consent, The Politics of Judicial Appointments. We're talking this afternoon about the role of partisanship and ideology in the nomination and confirmation process for federal judges and justices. My name is Celeste Quinn, and listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with your questions and comments. Here are the phone numbers. In the Champaign-Urbana Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. There is a chapter in the book, Advice and Consent, about vacancies, and you write at the outset of that chapter about Lyndon Johnson and Abe Fortas. Johnson wanted to make an appointment to the Supreme Court, and he wanted Fortas on the court, but there wasn't a vacancy. Tell us the story.
Well, he wanted, as you say, he wanted Fortas on the court, and there wasn't a vacancy, and he convinced Arthur Goldberg, who was then on the Supreme Court, to step down to become ambassador to the United Nations. Now, for most people, this is not a step up, and it's all, you know, there have always been rumors as to what it was that Johnson was able to do to get Goldberg to step down. Now, Johnson was an extraordinarily persuasive person, and he was president of the United States, and he did, in fact, suggest to Goldberg that if he went to the United Nations, his job there would be to negotiate an end to the Vietnam War, which may have been very appealing to Goldberg. But there's also a story in a book by David Stebbins that suggests that there was more than this, that President Johnson had some information about some possibly illegal fundraising that Goldberg had been involved with. And the reason that Johnson had this information is that the fundraising had been for Johnson himself that Goldberg was engaged in. That story's, you know, never been confirmed, but it does show up in this biography of Goldberg. So he was very effective at persuading people, you know, making appointments. Mm-hmm. Also, when he wanted to put Thurgood Marshall on the court, there wasn't a vacancy then either. He was able to get Supreme Court Justice Tom Clark to resign by putting Tom's son, Ramsey Clark, as Attorney General. And once Ramsey Clark was Attorney General, there would be a conflict of interest between the father and son. So Justice Clark resigned from the Supreme Court in order that Ramsey Clark could become Attorney General, and that created the vacancy for Thurgood Marshall.
Hmm. Are there recordings of phone calls like this?
Well, there are lots of recordings of Johnson's conversations, but I do not know if there are recordings on these sorts of on these specific events.
Yeah, be very interesting to know how that conversation went.
Sure.
So here we see now a role for politics in generating vacancies.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, and in fact, it's not just through the president. Your listeners who recall the famous case Marbury v. Madison. Will, if I'll jog their memory, remember that that whole case came about because of the midnight appointments that the Federalists pushed through when they lost control of the presidency and the House and the Senate in the election of 1800. And they pushed through these last-minute appointments. One of them went to William Marbury, and that led to the Marbury v. Madison case that in which the Supreme Court created judicial review.
Interesting. We've got a number of listeners now waiting to talk with you, Professor Siegel. So let's go and talk with our first listener this afternoon who's waiting for us on line one in Champaign. Hi.
Hello.
Hi there.
Is it me?
That's you. Go ahead.
Okay. Just to digress quickly to whom I think was an outstanding justice, Justice Louis Brandeis. You mentioned he suffered a lot of opposition, and it was because of his, quote, progressive views on economics. Was anti-Semitism also involved in the resistance that he suffered?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. One of the newspapers, the New York Sun at the time, feared that he would only be confirmed because of what they referred to as the racial factor. And by that they meant the fact that he was Jewish. So there were a lot of concerns about that at the time. When And not just in the country, but on the court itself. Later,
That's what I understand. On the court itself, he experienced.
Justice McReynolds. They used to take a picture of the court every year, and Justice McReynolds refused to have his picture taken with anyone who was Jewish.
Okay.
So yes.
All right. Second question is to this current court. I'm a liberal progressive and African American, so I was somewhat disappointed with Justice O'Connor, who's a woman, moderate conservative on many issues, being replaced by a conservative white male, leading many to say the court is too white and too male at this time. So apparently gender and race, because I expected maybe a Hispanic would break the barrier as well, is that no longer a significant factor?
No, it's still these factors will be significant. I mean, there will always, you know, I think one of the reasons that Bush tried for Harriet Myers was that she was female, and in fact, his wife before the nomination said that he was hoping that there would be a female candidate nominated, and it's impossible to believe that Bush would have. The First Lady would have said that without having cleared this or been asked to do so from the president or the president's office. So these things will still be a factor. There were, you know, I was surprised in some sense that he did not try to, if he's going to nominate someone conservative, he didn't go with one of the conservative Court of Appeals judges, because this would have been actually a great political benefit to Bush for naming the first Latino to the court, and possibly to the extent that if the Democrats were to oppose a well-qualified Latino like Emilio Garza or something like that, that would certainly help the Republicans gather support from Hispanics in the country.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks for the call. Next, we go to a listener in Champaign on line two. Hi.
Hi. First, let me say I was greatly honored and pleased to have studied constitutional law with the late, great Paul Freund, who had clerked for Justice Brandeis at the Supreme Court. And Professor Freund really did bring through to us in constitutional law that spirit of progressivism that obviously Brandeis had had brought to the court. Against so much opposition. And I submit that really what we're seeing today in these very bitter battles going back to Bork is an attempt by the members of the Federalist Society to reverse the New Deal gains and the New Deal Supreme Court, of which the foremost exemplar was Brandeis, and to bring us back to the Supreme Court of Calvin Coolidge and Herbert Hoover and Taft and the rest of them, and as it were to turn back the hands of time now, you know, almost 70 years. And that this is a deliberate strategy orchestrated by the Federalist Society. Both Alito and Roberts were members. Two-thirds of the federal judiciary at all levels have been appointed by Reagan, Bush Sr., Bush Jr. Large numbers of these individuals are members of the Federalist Society. In fact, that's why they all objected to Harriet Myers. It was not that Myers was unqualified, but rather she wasn't one of them, and in fact had earlier in her career stated that we do not need judges who had already made their mind up like the Federalist Society. And that's why they proceeded to savage her credentials when her credentials were every bit as good as those of Justice O'Connor when Reagan nominated her. And I think people have to understand how dangerous the Federalist Society really is. These lawyers and judges, law professors, are right-wing, racist, bigoted, reactionary, sexist, warmongering, totalitarian, and that is their agenda. And we now have four of these individuals on the Supreme Court, Clarence Thomas, Scalia, Alito and Roberts. And they are going to do the best they can to return the U.S. Supreme Court and the federal judiciary at all levels back to what they believe to be the good old days of Herbert Hoover and his Supreme Court.
Well, I don't think that we can brush the entire... Now, there are certainly elements of the Federalist Society that that certainly want to bring the Constitution back to 1935 or so. This movement is called the Constitution in Exile movement, and they take very seriously the Constitution's command that Congress has the ability to regulate interstate commerce, but not commerce solely within the state and stuff like that. But they're also the Federalist Society is actually a lot broader than that, and it has a lot of members who are. Represent a variety of different views on a variety of different issues. So I don't think they're quite that monolithic. As to the current Supreme Court, probably I think that the number of supporters of this agenda are not the four justices that you named, but maybe Justice Thomas, who seems to really go back to an originalist view on the commerce power. But I think that we'll see, even in this very term, that you know Scalia has already recognized that Congress has a great deal of power over commerce, and I think we'll see that Roberts and Alito will as well. There have been some instances where they've ruled otherwise, but I don't think we're going to see anything like we saw in the 1930s, where the Supreme Court was ruling that huge industries that had businesses in many, many different states were simply involved in intrastate commerce and not interstate commerce.
Well, I would agree with you. There are 35,000 members of the Federalist Society, but you have to look at who calls the shots and determines the policy. And that's Bob Bork, Ed Meese, who Jim Baker called the big bigot, Brad Reynolds, who Jim Baker called the little bigot, Lino Graglia, and a whole cast of characters along those lines. Plus, their money comes from the Scaife Foundation.
Right.
So I would agree you have large numbers of people, lawyers, who just joined to get ahead, okay?
Yeah.
But the shots are being called basically by Ed Meese and Bob Bork. And
well,
I really think we need to give that very serious consideration. And in fact, in the Alito and Roberts hearings, they pointed out that both these guys were groomed by Ed Meese at the Department of Justice.
Right. So let's say that at the Federalist Society, I don't know a lot about the internal workings of the Federalist Society, but let's say that the shots within the Federalist Society are being called by Bork or Meese or whatever. But what sway other than the potential persuasiveness of the arguments would they have over sitting Supreme Court justices? So the Federalist Society could call for a return to a 1930s jurisprudence, or much greater support for the takings clause, or other items on their agenda. But the fact that the Federalist Society doesn't want that doesn't mean that Alito or Roberts or whatever have any that's any more persuasive to them than any other argument about that.
Mm. I've got one more caller here waiting for us. I'm going to get to that individual here momentarily. I want to thank the listener who we just heard from for his call this afternoon. I wanted to ask you, Professor Siegel, before we take this next call, if you see the court signaling anything in particular in terms of the cases, the issues that I mentioned in my introduction, the Justice Department's appeal to reinstate what some call a ban on what some call partial birth abortions, and then the pair of cases involving the Clean Water Act.
Yeah, well, the Supreme Court is going to hear the question as to the constitutionality of the Partial Birth Act that Congress passed a few years ago, and it's very similar to a law that the Supreme Court has already struck down in Nebraska. But the difference is that Justice O'Connor, who sided with the majority, is no longer on the court, and she's been replaced by Justice Alito. Now, Justice Alito, when he was Judge Alito, struck down a similar law to that, but at the time he was on the Court of Appeals following the precedent of the Supreme Court. He's now on the Supreme Court and is not obliged to, you know, follow that same precedent. He now gets to help make that precedent. So it'll be interesting to see what the court does there. On these clean water cases, the question is whether Congress has the authority to regulate the cleanliness of water that does not flow into rivers that then flow into interstate commerce. The Bush administration has given a, you know, very, very strong defense of how this all has, you know, the overall economic impact of this affects the national economy. So I would be surprised if the court, you know, cuts back on the Clean Water Act, but it's possible that they will.
Okay, let's talk with our next caller, a listener in Eureka on line 4. Hi.
Hi, thank you very much. An extremely interesting program. Two short questions. Do you recall the composition of the 7-2 Roe v. Wade decision? Was it the...
White and Rehnquist were in dissent.
They were in dissent, yeah. Were the majority appointees of either Nixon or previous Republican presidents at that time that decided for?
Let's see now. So we had on the court was Blackmun, wrote the opinion, was a Nixon appointee. Mm-hmm. Berger was a Nixon appointee. Powell was a Nixon appointee. Then Brennan, who was an Eisenhower appointee. Marshall, who was a Johnson appointee. And see now, I'm missing two, or missing one. Stewart, who was an Eisenhower appointee. So that's actually the majority was almost entirely Republican appointee.
Okay, yeah, that's I had thought I had heard that. And the second question, and I guess it's kind of speculative, but it seems to me sometimes when they're throwing out the hot button issues like abortion or homosexuality or gay marriage, realizing they're very, very intense feelings, and I think it's used as a political organizing tactic for evangelical Christians of a very conservative political nature. I guess this is in the question. It often seems to me that they're thrown out as a smokescreen for when really a lot of the court is going backwards, as you were stating, maybe to the 30s or 40s in terms of really affecting everyone's rights by not protecting consumers and usually siding with many times with corporate America instead of the consumer or more or less average person. How would you respond to that?
Well, I think, yeah, I mean, look, you're absolutely right. On the one hand, we're going to have all this big media coverage over this partial birth abortion case, which, you know, the number of late term abortions in the United States is fairly small. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, we're, you know, companies are declaring that they're no longer bound by their pension obligations. Mm-hmm. And this is something that's going to affect the lives of millions of Americans very, very severely.
Yes. Yeah.
So, yes, there's, you know, but it is these social issues are just much more salient to people than some of these economic issues.
Could I make one more comment?
Sure.
That book about Kansas,
yes,
was on Book TV about how the Republicans have gotten ordinary working class people to vote against their own interests, I think is exactly right. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Professor Jeffrey Siegel, co-author of Advice and Consent, the Politics of Judicial Appointments. This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. We have time maybe for one more call if someone would like to join us with a question. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455. Well, we mentioned the external players a little earlier today in terms of the nomination of jurists. What about after the fact, after confirmation, or after someone joins the federal judiciary, does the federal bench feel the heat from interest groups, bloggers, media?
I think only in extreme circumstances. I think for the most part, there aren't the sort of constraints on federal judges that there are on other types of political leaders, that they don't have to worry about re-election or things like that. On the other hand, people are, you know, members of their communities, and when things get very hot, I'm sure they feel that sort of stuff. But I think it would take a lot in most circumstances for that to really have a significant influence.
Okay, let's take one more call here this afternoon. Champagne, line four, hi.
Hi. I listened earlier about Johnson, how he got to. That was fascinating. Are there any other?
I'm sorry. I suspect that listener is on a cell phone and she's just dropping away. So I can't tell. I can't understand what she was trying to ask there. So apologies to everybody. Sorry to the caller who can't get to ask her question and to the rest of us who can't enjoy the exchange here this afternoon as well. Now we're right up against time, Professor Siegel. Anything you'd like to, what should we end on here? Maybe, is there any way to reduce the heat, to reduce the partisan bickering, and to take a look at the issues that really count and take a look at them, you know, maybe in a spirited way, but, you know, in a little bit more calm manner?
The only way that that's going to happen is if the court becomes less political, but I don't think there's any likelihood of that. As long as there is such a, you know, the reason that people care so much about the, these interest groups and the senators care so much about the ideology of the justices is that the ideology of the justices has so much to do with how they vote on cases before them. So as long as the justices are acting ideologically, then it seems reasonable to expect that the senators are going to, and the interest groups are going to, act ideologically. If the justices weren't so ideological, people just wouldn't care so much, and there would be more attention to these, qualifications issues and things like that. But since conservatives vote conservatively and liberals vote liberally, conservatives want conservatives on the court and liberals want liberals on the court.
Well, maybe more people will go out and vote.
There are consequences to elections.
Right. There we'll leave it. I want to thank you very much for joining us this afternoon.
It was my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Political scientist Jeffrey Siegel has been our guest in this portion of the afternoon magazine. He is the co-author with Lee Epstein of Advice and Consent, The Politics of Judicial Appointments. The book is a guide for general readers. It is published by Oxford University Press. Our guest this afternoon, Jeffrey Siegel, distinguished professor and department chair of political science at Stony Brook University.